From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
If I told him, would he like it? Would he like it if I told him? Would he like it? Would he like it? If Napoleon, would he like it if I told him? Would he like it if I told him, would he like it? Would he like it if I told him? Now, not now, and now. Now, exactly as king.
That's a bit of Gertrude Stein reading her poem, If I Told Him, a completed portrait of Picasso. In Paris, during the early days of the 20th century, Stein was raising the roof on poetry. On this side of the Atlantic, Chicago poet Harriet Monroe launched a magazine to encourage writers who were shaking poetry's foundations. Poetry Magazine's 100 years old now, and we're throwing a poetry house party. From online verse to the new U.S. Poet Laureate to the form-forging work of Ann Carson, we're packed to the rafters with poets. Come on in. Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky, like a patient etherized upon a table. Let us go through certain half-deserted streets, the muttering retreats of restless nights in one-night cheap hotels and sawdust restaurants with oyster shells, streets that follow like a tedious argument of insidious intent to lead you to an overwhelming question. Oh, do not ask, what is it? Let us go and make our visit. T.S. Eliot's The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock was first published by Poetry Magazine in 1915. The magazine's early editions also included new poems and essays from Ezra Pound, William Carlos Williams, and Marianne Moore. Today, the magazine still maintains its open-door policy, considering submissions regardless of poetic genre. It's also a home to poetry criticism. Christian Wyman has been the magazine's editor for nearly 10 years. Steve Paulson talked with him.
How would you describe the role of Poetry Magazine, both for the poetry community and for the culture at large?
You know, that's changed over the years because when poetry was founded, it had a tiny little audience, probably about 500 people, but kind of outsized significance. Because in some of its first issues appeared Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot and D.H. Lawrence and even people like Ernest Hemingway and Samuel Beckett. And so it sort of ramified around the world from that little cell in Chicago. Over the years, we've grown, and our circulation now is up to 30,000, and we reach probably a million through the Poetry Foundation website every month. But in a way, our role has never changed. It's still the discovery of new poets, and our role is to get their work as broadly exposed as possible. But it's still the same. It's poem by poem. It's poet by poet. And, you know, the greatest excitement for us is when we come across somebody that's some voice that's just completely new.
Does that happen very often?
Well, no. That's why it's so exciting. I mean, it's quite rare, actually, when some voice really leaps out at you and you recognize something new. I remember sitting in my office when I first took this job and reading poems by someone named Atsuro Riley. He turned out to be of Japanese descent, raised in the Deep South. He has since published a single book of poems, but the voice was so inimitable and so clearly new, and it just leapt out at me, and I took everything he sent and everything he sent subsequently. And it's happened, you know, several times over the years that there have been people like that where you realize that something is really sparking fresh. It's really new. And those are definitely the most exciting times for Don Scherer and I. He's the senior editor at Poetry, and he and I discuss everything as we're going through the process.
So it sounds like what you love the most is a singular voice, a poet who doesn't sound like anyone else.
I think so. I think, you know, you can make too much of originality. I think it's possible to accomplish great and durable things in conventional voices. So it's not necessarily a style or a voice that's so exciting. That is sort of an obvious excitement, but it's some sort of emotional or intellectual freshness that comes to you, and it can come to you in different ways.
Hmm. Now, I think a lot of people see a fundamental tension in sort of two poles of poetry. On one side, they're very accessible poems that that pretty much everyone can get, but perhaps not too sophisticated. And on the other side, the incredibly complex, difficult poems that perhaps only other poets really appreciate. Do you see that as the fundamental tension in the world of poetry?
I guess I have different answers to it. In a way, yes, that pole does exist. Some kinds of poetry are quite difficult, and I think you would need to be a specialist to read them. There's no doubt. And then there's this whole other kind that's quite accessible, like Billy Collins. But the bandwidth in between those poles is so wide. There's all kinds of things in there. For instance, Robert Frost I would put somewhere directly in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
He's someone who's, I think, accessible to a lot of people, but then there's all kinds of complexity within that clarity. So the more you look, the more you find in those poems.
So which way does your own aesthetic tilt?
I do lean toward poems that are accessible to general readers. I want people who are not specialists in poetry to be able to read Poetry Magazine. If we have something in there that I think is particularly difficult or innovative, we will often try to find some way of giving people an entrance into it. So sometimes we do a Q&A with the author afterwards or something like that.
Mm-hmm. How many new poems would you say you read every week? Poems that come into your magazine?
More than you would want to read, let me tell you.
Well, I've heard that there's something like 90,000 poems that are submitted to Poetry Magazine every year. Is that
more,
right?
More. It's gone up. Yeah, it's gone up. Now that we're taking online submissions, you know, we get them from all around the world. And we think it's up to about 110. We haven't done an official count, it's about 110,000.
Wow. Do you ever get into arguments about whether a poem is good or not?
We definitely disagree, but I wouldn't say they're arguments.
Fierce disagreements or gentle disagreements?
They're gentle disagreements.
Well, I guess it raises the question of whether poetry is a genteel world or whether it can actually get kind of rough and tumble.
Oh, my God. You know, I mean, Robert Frost once said in answer to that question, you know, if poetry was a means of relaxation or something, he said poetry is a means of taking life by the throat. A life in poetry is a very difficult thing. Very difficult, not only because the technique is so difficult, so arduous to master and requires so many years, but because there's no reward for so long, and maybe never. And that's why I see part of our role at the magazine is reaching into the lives of poets out there who are experiencing that kind of loneliness that I know about, and bolstering them a bit as best we can.
Well, your magazine has quite a history. Yeah, I wonder, are you ever haunted by the ghosts of Ezra Pound and Marianne Moore and William Carlos Williams or the magazine's founder, Harriet Monroe, who published all those great early modernist poets, or even Ruth Lilly, who gave your foundation $200 million 10 years ago? Do you feel pressure to live up to the history of Poetry Magazine?
I do. When I first took on the magazine, I didn't. Maybe it was brash or something, but I didn't feel a history as much as I do now. And it may be that Don and I have just put together this centennial anthology, which is coming out in October. It's called The Open Door, 100 Poems and 100 Years of Poetry Magazine. And so we read through the entire archives, some 30,000, 40,000 poems. That was a daunting and sobering and chastening task, because you do see these masterpieces jut out of the magazine, but you also see that most of what is there is it gets lost.
But if you've been looking back over 100 years of just what's been published in Poetry Magazine, you must have a very keen sense of the modern history of poetry and a sense of which are the good periods and which are the not so good periods. Which are we in now? Is this a good time for poetry?
I think it is, but it's much more difficult to judge poetry and literature in general than it is now because it's just so much bigger. You know, I got a letter recently from Donald Hall, a well-known poet, been the poet laureate. And when he came up, you know, you might publish a book and you might sell 750 copies, but it would be reviewed in the New Yorker and the New Republic and the New York Times and all these places. And now you might actually sell a lot more copies, but a book will sink, it will seem to sink like a stone.
So the place of poetry in our culture is much less than it once was.
Well, I don't know that that's true. I think actually in terms of scope, it's probably much more. The literary world used to be much more concentrated. It had this intense influence, but it didn't reach into all kinds of communities that now it does, that are now asserting their voices. The literary world is simply an incoherent place now. And that's a good thing, I think, not a bad thing. I think it's good. The tumult of it is a very good thing.
We've been talking about the art of poetry. Your magazine also publishes a lot of criticism, and you yourself are a critic as well as a poet. What's the role of criticism in the poetry community?
Oh, it's twofold. When I took over, I really wanted to shake up the world of criticism and brought in all these young critics and just gave them free rein. And it caused enormous controversy because some very famous poets took hard beatings in the pages of poetry. And in the poetry culture at large, I think it's necessary to have that kind of friction between the young and the old. It's always been the way it is. It's shaking out the good from the bad. The other is drawing attention to what might otherwise get passed over. And that's probably ultimately much more important. And I do think that, as always, many of the best poets writing are the least known. I tend to think that things would get lost if you didn't have someone telling you how to read it, someone paying some kind of early attention to it. It may be that we would have come to T.S. Eliot eventually. The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock was T.S. Eliot's first publication, and it appeared in Poetry Magazine. And Ezra Pound had to convince Harriet Monroe to publish it. And in fact, the readers hated it. So that's an example of criticism, I think, being the prow that breaks the ice.
Do you ever get tired of reading poetry?
Oh, you bet. No, you bet. I get sick to death of it. Yeah.
Well, you often hear, for instance, movie reviewers are, you know, having to watch a dozen movies every week. You know, that's the last thing in the world they want to do, especially when so much of it is tripe.
Right. Yeah, no, there's no question. I get sick of it. And, I mean, how could you not? Some of the best readers of poetry I've ever known were people who hated poetry. They were so sick of it, they couldn't, they were just had become all beak and talon when they were coming at it. But we talk about this all the time. We talk about how you fight off fatigue and how you do remain open to the new thing when it's there. I mean, if you're in that state of hating poetry, I mean, you're going to miss it.
So if you're looking for inspiration, are there certain poets you turn to? Do you have particular touchstones?
Well, the 16th century poet George Herbert is so close to my heart. He had this tension between ambition and a calling from God, and he became a priest, and he wrote some of the most beautiful poems in the language, clear, heart-piercing poems. Eliot, whom I've already mentioned a couple of times, is another one. There are many, though.
I think I may have finally figured out what you look for in poetry. It's the priestly function. It's the poet who is dipping her quill into the sacred waters.
Well, it's interesting. I am most compelled by poetry that seeks transcendence, or at least believes in transcendence in some way. At the same time, I think that can get very fuzzy and frustrating. Often what we think of as being transcendent is actually the most specific thing that can be rendered. You know, when Pound wrote that great little couplet that appeared in poetry early on in the first year, 1912, is the apparition of these faces in the crowd, petals on a wet, black bough. That's it. That's the whole poem in a station of the metro. And he sort of changed the whole language right then. And that's a poem that seems to me at once utterly transcendent because it makes you see this scene in a completely different way and yet utterly specific. It renders that world to a pointless degree, to a precision that you wouldn't have thought possible. And so when I say that I love poems that have some degree of transcendence, I tend to think of it actually as inhering in that kind of specificity that you get in a poem like that in a station at the metro.
Christian Wyman is a poet, essayist, and editor of Poetry Magazine. Steve Paulson talked with him. You can hear Wyman reading his own work by going to our website, ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
I wanted to write a poem that rhymes, but revolution doesn't lend itself to bebopping. Then my neighbor who thinks I hate asked, "Do you ever write tree poems? I like trees." So I thought, I'll write a beautiful green tree poem. Peek from my window to check the image. Notice the schoolyard was covered with asphalt, no green. No trees grow in Manhattan. Then, well, I thought, the sky. I'll do a big blue sky poem. But all the clouds have winged low since No Dick was elected. So I thought again, and it occurred to me, maybe I shouldn't write at all, but clean my gun and check my kerosene supply. Maybe these are not poetic times at all.
That's Nikki Giovanni reading her poem for Sandra. It's a great poem. Don't you wish you could send it to a friend right now? And find more poems like it? Kathy Halley runs the digital programs of the Poetry Foundation. Anne Strainchamps asked her how and what people are reading on the web.
There's a site called Stumbled Upon, and that's a site that allows users to thumbs up. It's crowdsourced poetry reading, I guess, in some ways. And what I find is that poems by E.E. Cummings in particular are incredibly popular. So you've got two things, two sort of parallel trends. One, you see those kinds of poems that folks will put on Stumbled Upon. And then you also see the poems that are really popular in classrooms by people like Robert Frost, who are taught in the classroom. Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening is one of our most popular poems and has been for years.
So these are the kind of greatest hits poems.
Yes, the greatest hits poems. You can't really game social media. You can try to put poems that are different up on Facebook and that kind of thing. But what happens is 30,000 people will come to a random E.E. Cummings poem or to a Edna St. Vincent Millay poem because someone has decided that they like it and they've shared it with millions of internet users.
How many visitors are you averaging?
We have about 1.2 million visitors, unique visitors a month right now.
That's a lot of people for a form of literature that people often say is in decline, doesn't have a big readership anymore.
It's interesting. I think that people use poems to help them express themselves when they can't. They use poems for occasions. And that has been really the bulk of our traffic for the past few years. Folks coming to the site to find poems for weddings or for funerals. I think that people have a use for poetry in a way that they don't necessarily for stories. Some of the best data, I say, that I get from my constituents is to look at the reviews of the app. Oh, I was looking for a poem for a particular occasion or to tell someone I loved them, and I found it.
Now, you're talking about the poetry app, which is very cool. So we should talk about this. It's kind of like a slot machine for poetry.
It is a slot machine for poetry. I think I'm not supposed to use that language to talk about it. But it's true because you shake your phone or you hit a spin button and you land on a random combination of a subject and a mood. So you might get, for instance, family and anger. I always say, mad at your dad? There's a poetry app for that.
Well, the thing that I think is so ingenious about it is that, of course, you can't just spin once.
Yes. You know, we have found that folks tend to browse around the app even more than they do on the website. And I think it's because of that spin function. They'll look at 12 poems when they're looking at the app versus one or two or three when they're on the website. I really wanted it to be like a game.
Mm-hmm.
And so the interface is very entertaining and colorful and beautiful. It's for magpie readers of poetry, I guess.
Okay, well, so for instance, I'm looking at my phone now. Your app says, "Welcome to Poetry, spin." So I'm pressing spin. And I get all these colors swirling. Okay, so let's see. I've got two bars, and it's offering me, I could choose nostalgia, optimism, disappointment, worry, blame, humor, joy. Let's choose joy. And on the bottom, I can choose work and play, celebrate, life, youth, aging. Oh, let's choose aging. I'm getting older every minute. Wow, it's giving me 14 poems on joy and aging. Oh, here's one very short. One Day by Robert Creeley. One day after another, perfect. They all fit. That's great. Kathy, do you use the app much yourself, just for fun?
Constantly, and I'm not just testing it. I use it on the subway a lot, in the grocery line. I use it exactly where I anticipated that other folks would use it. And it takes me out of my surroundings and into myself.
Hmm. You said that people are spending more time on the app than they are online. That sort of makes sense, don't you think? Because, well, for one thing, when we're online, a lot of us are working. Whereas your phone, you know, you carry with you and you can look at it when you're standing online at the post office.
That's right. You don't need an internet connection to use the app. I think the internet is incredibly distracting. One of the things that's fascinating is that our reach for the website has grown and grown and grown by 500%. But the amount of time that people spend on the site and the number of pages that they look at is getting smaller. And I'm not surprised by that, actually. But the app, it creates this really quiet space.
Poetry, it seems to me, well, especially the lyric poetry, really is about sort of opening that door to enter into a different kind of perception, stepping out of the busyness of your daily life and into what Virginia Woolf called a moment of being. So in that sense, it seems just so perfectly well-suited for these little bite-size apps.
It's true. There's also another form of poetry that's digital native poetry, you might call it. So I think you've got both things. You've got those quiet poems, but you've also got these other folks who are either using the internet or other forms of media and the noise and turning it into poetry because they force you to look at it slightly differently. So I think both things are at work.
So has this work, especially thinking about dissecting poems, has this changed or is it changing the way you read poems yourself?
You know what? The answer to that question is no, because I think that I'm able to turn off the part of my brain that looks at poetry as data because I need poems. I need poems to provide that kind of intimate experience with me. I have to have that intimate relationship with poetry, and so I protect it.
Is there a particular gift you think poetry could give us in the digital age?
I think poetry will continue to give us that kind of intimate relationship with language that is slowly disappearing. I always moan about, I say, oh, look at Pinterest. Language is becoming captions. It's becoming captions. What's happening to us? But actually, I think lines of a poem, it makes you pay attention to the sound of language, to the materiality of language, to the way that language looks on a page or on a screen. And I think that that's what poems will continue to do.
Well, you make me feel very hopeful about the future of poetry then.
I'm glad. I feel very hopeful about it too.
Kathy Halley is the director of digital programs at the Poetry Foundation. After Anne talked with her, we made a house call to get the scoop on the foundation's latest new media experiment. It is a poetry recommendation engine. Here's Halley and her staff briefing a new team member on the project they've nicknamed Pandora for Poetry.
So, Nerea, one of the projects that we're working on that we're really excited about is a poem recommendation engine. We have an archive of 10,000 poems, and the same 150 or 200 poems are surfaced over and over and over again. So we wanted to broaden the number of poems that are actually exposed. There's a couple of different people who are the ideal audience for this. One of them is a novice poetry reader who might be afraid of poetry. I think it also helps an expert poetry reader develop their taste. So if they are convinced that they really are, that they're a Gertrude Stein addict, they love Gertrude Stein, exposing them slowly to other poets who are similar to Gertrude Stein might help broaden their taste. So that's really the reasoning behind a lot of this.
Well, some other reasons for building the recommendation engine are to get poems to connect with what we're calling their true siblings or their true neighbors, showing connections in the poetry world that we haven't been able to show yet.
One of the things we were trying to do was to categorize poems in a very formal way and then match poems up that we may have never put together even. So it's not just finding poems that people are surprised by, that readers are surprised by, but even we were surprised by. Now how we've organized our poems are largely by subject and theme. Where we seem to be headed is sort of a much more formal approach to describing the poem and to modeling out what a poem sort of is on paper outside of what it's about.
I mean, I wouldn't say that it would be a new way of reading and analyzing poetry, but many recommendation engines look on the surface of, let's say, a movie or a song. And what we want to do is look deeply into the language of poems. And so what we'll be adding in terms of metadata would be a long list of linguistic characteristics. So we want to get as deeply as we can into describing the way a poem works and all the techniques that are available to poets or anyone using language, what kind of choices they make and how that takes shape in the poem.
Well, so this just is the beginning of the modeling process. So we sort of sat in a room and started talking about poems, and then we started talking about ways to label these poems and to model these poems. And so this is the first test engine.
This is Chaplin-esque by Hart Crane. So here are a list of the genes that some of the genes that we've come up with. These have to do with how it looks on the page. We've looked at the way the syntax is working in this poem, voice that's being used, the way that metaphor, simile, things like that are used in the poem.
Are we looking for poems that are really close to their interest based on the poem that they're in, or, you know, kind of what's the sensitivity or the threshold in pushing those visitors into something that's really different?
Yeah, I mean, that really comes to the question of, do you give someone what they think they already know that they want and are really staying within that filter bubble, or do we have almost an ethical responsibility to push people outside of their filter bubbles?
She's really, really high-minded.
You're going to read one of these tenure buttons if it's the last thing you will like Gertrude Stein.
That's the Poetry Foundation staff talking about the poetry recommendation engine they're creating. You can find a link to their site from ours, ttbook.org. For all this looking into the future of poetry, sometimes poetry is also about history and memory. Many of Natasha Trethewey's poems are windows on history. Steve Paulson spoke with Trethewey shortly after she was appointed to be American Poet Laureate.
First of all, congratulations on being appointed Poet Laureate. What was your first reaction when you heard the news?
Well, shock and disbelief. And then immediately I began to think about the tremendous responsibility that comes with it.
What do you see as what a U.S. Poet Laureate can do?
Well, the thing that the Poet Laureate is supposed to do is to bring poetry to as wide and broad an audience as possible. And I think that there are many ways that I can do that. And I look forward to thinking up new ways as I imagine thinking of a project that I might undertake.
Well, we should get a taste of your own poetry, and I'm wondering if you could read for us, maybe from your book Native Guard, which won a Pulitzer Prize. Could you read The Southern Crescent?
I'd be happy to. In 1959, my mother is boarding a train. She is barely 16, her one large grip bulging with homemade dresses, whisper of crinoline and lace, her name stitched inside each one. She is leaving behind the dirt roads of Mississippi, the film of red dust around her ankles, the thin whistle of wind through the floorboards of the shotgun house, the very idea of home. Ahead of her, days of travel, one town after the next, and California, a word she can't stop repeating. Over and over, she will practice meeting her father, imagine how he must look, how different now from the one photo she has of him, She will look at it once more, pulling into the station at Los Angeles, and then again and again on the platform, no one like him in sight. The year the old crescent makes its last run, my mother insists we ride it together. We leave Gulfport late morning, heading east. Years before, we rode together to meet another man, my father, waiting for us as our train derailed. I don't recall how she must have held me, how her face sank as she realized again the uncertainty of it all, that trip, too, gone wrong. Today, she is sure we can leave home, bound only for whatever awaits us, the sun now setting behind us, the rails humming like anticipation, the train pulling us toward the end of another day. I watch each small town pass before my window until the light goes and the reflection of my mother's face appears, clearer now as evening comes on, dark and certain.
That's wonderful. Thank you. Your work is so much about memory, about history, your personal history, the history of the South, a history of the United States. What can poetry do in particular to illuminate these subjects?
Well, I think that what poetry can do is not only touch the intellect, but also the heart. And so there's a way of learning about history through poetry that add something to it in such a way that it becomes a little bit more memorable, perhaps, because of the elegant envelope of form, because of the cadences of poetry. It can connect us to our past and remind us across time and space how we are alike, and not that we are different.
Is there something about the form of poetry then? I don't know, maybe the repetitive quality that some poems have that can call up forgotten pieces of history?
Oh, I certainly think that repetition helps, that repetitive quality that you're talking about, to instill something in the memory. When I was working on the poems in Native Guard, which are very much about recalling history that had been lost or forgotten, lesser known stories, or even those that weren't necessarily recorded in as many books as we'd like to see, it became necessary for me not just to say a thing, but to say it again. And so repetition formally became a technique to re-inscribe and thus remember those forgotten things.
Why are you so interested in memory yourself?
Well, I'm mostly interested in history. And when we say memory, I should clarify what I mean by that. I actually mean cultural memory, collective memory, our memory as Americans of our shared history. So my personal memories have a lot to do with it, but I'm more interested in the collective memory, which is really another way of talking about history or the myths that we create about our past.
But that's interesting because I think a lot of people, when they talk about history, they wouldn't necessarily use that phrase, collective memory. But mm-hmm. that seems to be the thing that you gravitate to, that maybe it's because the collective memory is not always told in the history books.
Well, that's right. But also the collective memory is often the memory that's created by those of us who are more in power to create the memories. For example, if you were to drive around the South, and perhaps you'd never been to the South or to the United States, you might think, after seeing all the Confederate monuments, that the South actually won the war. That's the collective memory of a people by inscribing on the landscape with monuments the story we want to tell. That's one of the reasons that personal memory sometimes, or personal history, or other stories that we know to exist that aren't being told, not only sort of converges, but then bumps up against sort of larger public histories that are recorded through the cultural or collective memory of the people. And so what I think we need to do is to tell fuller versions of our stories as Americans, not leaving out the other part of the story that can tell us more about who we are.
So what have you done in your own poems to try to counteract that, more official Southern memory, which tends to celebrate the Confederacy?
Well, one of the things I do is to write this sequence of poems about the Louisiana Native Guards, who were one of the first officially sanctioned regiment of African American Union soldiers to whom no monuments have been erected. I create this sort of lyrical monument in words so that we remember them alongside the Confederate prisoners they were guarding.
Could you give us an example of that? Could you read one of your poems?
Pilgrimage, Vicksburg, Mississippi. Here the Mississippi carved its mud-dark path, a graveyard for skeletons of sunken riverboats. Here the river changed its course, turning away from the city as one turns, forgetting from the past. The abandoned bluffs, land sloping up above the river's bend, where now the Yazoo fills the Mississippi's empty bed. Here the dead stand up in stone, white marble on Confederate Avenue. I stand on ground once hollowed by a web of caves. They must have seemed like catacombs in 1863 to the woman sitting in her parlor, candle lit, underground. I can see her listening to shells explode, writing herself into history, asking what is to become of all the living things in this place. This whole city is a grave. Every spring pilgrimage, the living come to mingle with the dead, brush against their cold shoulders in the long hallways, listen all night to their silence and indifference, relive their dying on the green battlefield. At the museum, we marvel at their clothes, preserved under glass, so much smaller than our own, as if those who wore them were only children. We sleep in their beds, the old mansions hunkered on the bluffs, draped in flowers funereal, a blur of petals against the river's gray. The brochure in my room calls this living history. The brass plate on the door reads Prissy's room. A window frames the river's crawl toward the gulf. In my dream, the ghost of history lies down beside me, rolls over, pins me beneath a heavy arm.
Mm. What's so striking about hearing you read, you're both talking history, but you're talking about life right now. I mean, you almost can't separate the two.
Right. And I think that's one of the reasons that I'm so drawn to writing about history, because of course, like a lot of people, you know, I'm interested in my own autobiography. I'm interested in my own personal story, but really only to the extent that it is part of a larger ongoing history of not only Americans, but people around the world. So I like to use the lens of history to make sense of my place in the world, what it is I've been given to write.
Natasha Trethewey is the author of three books of poetry, including the Pulitzer Prize-winning Native Guard. Steve Paulson spoke with her shortly after she was named U.S. Poet Laureate. If you'd like to hear more of her poems, visit our website, ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Our final interview in Poems Old and New is with a writer who's constantly rearranging poetry's furniture. Ann Carson has written short talks, verse novels, essays as tangos, prose poems, illustrated poetry collections, and more. Carson's also a classic scholar who's translated or re-translated Sappho, Euripides, Sophocles, and other ancient writers. In book after book, Carson forges new poetic forms. I asked her about the shapes poems can take.
For the ancients, form was, they didn't have a word for that really. They had genres, but genres arose out of occasions. So if you were getting married, you would hire a poet to make a wedding song. And if you had a death, you would hire someone to make a funeral lament. And there weren't people sitting around trying to think up forms like sonnets and villanelles just to amuse themselves with language. But we have a completely different view of how poetic activity works, and we don't have those kind of occasions anymore demanding certain kinds of language. So it's all become an invention. So form now is a way of setting the thought free.
So it's important, but in a new and more modern way, I guess.
Yeah, more modern, or at least more, I don't know, egotistical, really, is the difference. Everything in modern culture is about being original and making your little face visible among the mass of other little faces on the screen. So forms become about inventing something that wasn't there before. For Homer, that wasn't the case. He was happy to settle into the old dactylic hexameter and do it just the same as everybody always did.
Somehow that doesn't sound quite right, though, does it? Because he seems unique.
His thought is unique, but there's a kind of collaboration between his thought and his form that's already available to him when he sits down. It's already there. He locks into a method and he goes ahead like a train on a track. For us, there's a tension. There's always a search in between. There's a gap in between what we want to say and how to say it.
Is this one of the reasons why you have worked in so many different forms? Your work is so varied. I mean, you've written essays, you've written poems, you have what look like poetry to me, but you call them short talks. You're searching all the time for the best way to present your ideas?
Yes, it's searching. That's exactly right. Or groping. Searching sounds more positive and directed. It's more like groping. Because really the form has to arise out of the thought. So it's a way of setting it free somehow from all the things that are impediments to what it wants to be. There is some kind of inherent form in an idea. And I don't think that I can find a way to let the idea come out unless I get the right form.
How does it work? Do you know when you approach an idea what the best way to present it is going to be?
No, I hardly ever know. I mess around and mess around and mess around and look for accidents just to try to make something come out of unexpectedness. And then I get into a free space where the thing, the thought, and me are working together without presumptions about each other.
Maybe we could take a couple of examples to get a feel for it. The short talks are something that I found very appealing. They look pretty standard on the page.
Well, that's now a good example of the function of accident, because those were originally drawings. I mostly, in my early years, had no interest in writing particularly. I wanted to be a person who made drawings and did a lot of drawings. And I made a book of drawings called Short Talks, which had titles. And nobody liked the drawings, but they did like the titles. So I started to expand the titles into very long titles, and then they became talks. And then the drawings kind of faded out of the thing and it got published as a book. But it was entirely backwards. You see, the way it came to be, a little thing on a page that looked like a lecture, was not what I intended at all.
I love some of these. And maybe it's just that the way in which you phrase them brings those pictures so to life. The little short talk on reading. The last line when you say, "I do not look at hair on female flesh without thinking deciduous." Is that a real memory for you of being in the car while your father drove you and you read in the back seat?
No, I made that up, but it came out of a drawing of a mountain. See, that was the interesting thing about having the drawings subtracted forcibly by somebody else from the book, is that I then had to, in my own mind, put the drawing back into the language without having a drawing be there as such. So that's what made the language different. I think that's what makes it satisfying to the mind's eye.
Maybe that's an interesting point to turn to Knox, the work that began as a collection of things as you thought about your brother. The production of the book is also a change from the way in which things like that are usually presented. It comes in a box, and it is essentially an accordion fold, so you could put it up on the wall the way you could put a panorama.
Yes, you can unfold it on your kitchen floor. Or a better thing to do if you have a multi-story house is to go to the top of a stairway and drop it down, because it makes it unfurls page by page, and it makes this wonderful crackly sound as it unfurls.
So it adds one more element of sound.
Yes, and performance.
You know, this isn't what most people would call poetry. Do you call it poetry?
No, I don't think I do, really. I don't know what to call it. In ancient Greek, they just call poetry making. You know, poiesis means making. That seems respectful of the activity. I've written a lot of things that I called essays because no one can exactly say what that is.
Speaking of essays, I was reading one recently about technique and form, and it argued that writers need to learn to excel in classical forms in order to refine their craft. I suppose the idea is that they need to learn what the constraints are so they can surmount them. It'll somehow make them better writers. Mm. Does that make sense to you?
Well, I don't know much about forms, standard English forms. I think I never was trained in that. So I guess for me that kind of exercise would be a way of putting in time till you have an idea. And then once you have the idea, well, it will come with its own form, and you do that. Mm. So, yeah, I don't do a lot of sitting around writing villanelles to train myself.
What's fascinating in a way is that I understand you were a classical scholar by training, a professor of classics. A lot of people would assume that that means you would have a thorough understanding of forms. You're saying that's completely untrue.
Well, I never took English, so the English forms are foreign to me. I took Greek and Latin, and as I say, those forms are genres. They're occasions of life. They're not invented literary artifacts. It's a whole different approach to what a poem does for its audience.
I think that's fascinating because you've done so much translation. You say you never took English, so your translation was from something you knew inside out into something you hadn't studied except as a, like the rest of us, a normal person who speaks the language.
An amateur, yeah, totally amateur, yes. But the thing about being an amateur is that it opens out that space for the third thing to happen. If I'm totally professional and locked into my credentials as a professional, I can't let you have a thought about what I'm telling you. I have to make you have my thought about what I'm telling you, and I just don't like doing that. It's not teaching. It's closing off teaching.
Well, I'm thinking now about how this affects the reading of the fragments of Sappho that you have offered. There isn't a lot of Sappho for us to look at, is there? There's one more or less complete Sappho poem?
Yeah, just one. The rest are fragmentary.
And in that sense, you have to find a way to take those fragments and make some sense of them.
Yes. But sense, you know, we've all learned from the history of psychoanalysis that any five words on a page will become a story when you go in and start thinking about your childhood. There just is sense everywhere. So I think with Sappho, the main thing to do is to hold off giving a sense and let the sense emerge for the reader from what's left there and from the spaces around it. However, it's an interesting thing with that book that in the response to it, several people, I would say maybe half a dozen people since I published it, have written to me or sent me projects that they did filling in all the blanks. So making Sappho a complete text with sentences that go from right to left or right of the page. And it's kind of an endearing thing to do, but it's so hopelessly silly.
And yet, I suppose that is in some ways what each of us does looking at it. You have, not on the pages perhaps, that have 17 blanks and one word.
Well, you do in a way, but here's what you really do with that. You have the text there with the blanks, and you have your filled-in supposition in your mind, and somehow both of them are able to be layered and to be real in your consciousness at the same time. So you have the presence and the absence together, which is totally thrilling. I mean, that's what we like about poetry, that it does that all the time. It gives and it doesn't give at the same time.
Ann Carson's latest book of poetry is called Knox. She's also recently reimagined Antigone in an illustrated play called Antigonic. You can hear our extended interview with Carson on our website, ttbook.org. And though she doesn't use classical forms much, she did perform a series of sonnets for dance. Here's one called Sonnet Isolate, performed at New York's 92nd Street Y.
Sonnet Isolate. Epigraph. I force myself to contradict myself in order to avoid conforming to my own taste. Marcel Duchamp. A sonnet is a rectangle upon the page. Your eye enjoys it in a ratio of 8 to 5. Let's say you are an urgent man in an urgent language, construing the millions of shadows that keep you alive.
If only it were water, or innocent, or a hog from a handsaw.
If only you were Adonis or Marcel Duchamp.
If only you were Adonis or Marcel Duchamp.
Settling into your half hour of sex or chess. Not this raw block cut out of the fog of meaning, still damp. But no, you are alone. Whatever idea here rises from its knees, to turn and face you quicker than a kiss or a hyphen or the very first moment you felt the breeze of being a creature who will die one day, not this. We'll ask of you most of your cunning and a deep blue release like a sigh while using only two pronouns,
I and not I.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear some of these poems again, follow us on Facebook or Twitter, where we'll be sharing poetic links. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Poems Old and New. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Sarah Nix, with the help of Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, Anne Strainchamps, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.